It's always an enriching experience to worship with you here at South Yarra, and Margaret and I have appreciated it very much. And we also appreciate the way in which in the internet age, from the other side of the world, we can keep in touch with what's going on here. And I want to thank you for the gift of being invited to undertake the ministry of the word among you this evening. Now, in our Bible readings, we've just heard three quite stark confessions, which I repeat in the version from the New Revised Standard Version. Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. I am the least of the apostles, unfit to be called an apostle. Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. It's one of the world's most famous plays. It's full of violence, battle, treachery, murder, lust for power. It includes the assassination of a king and revenge. The ghost of one victim appears and terrifies the murderer. What's more, running through it all, there's witchcraft, spells, scary incantations. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble, eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog, for a charm of powerful trouble like a hell broth boil and bubble. It's about a curse laid upon people. The play is Shakespeare's, I wonder if I should give its name. There's a superstition in the theatrical world that even mentioning the name of this play brings bad luck. Charles Heston got his thighs burnt. Laurence Olivier was nearly killed by a weight falling from the stage scenery once. Some say the play is cursed by the witches who feature in it, so actors call it the Scottish play, instead of its real name, which, I'll say it anyway, is, of course, Macbeth. Macbeth is set in late medieval Scotland. Shakespeare wrote it more than 400 years ago, but the play still has a haunting message for today about how evil can come to infect a whole society through one person's ambition. Macbeth murders the king, Duncan, seizes the throne, and thereafter is trapped in guilt and misery and drags so many others into his hell. He and the whole of Scotland seem under the curse pronounced by the witches. The question then is, how can the curse, the infection of evil, be lifted? But that poses a further question. Can you get to grips with evil without becoming mired in evil yourself? Can you clean up the mess without yourself getting dirty in the process? If politics, as is often said, is a dirty business, who can go into it and retain a clear conscience? One of the key scenes in the play is when the main goody in the story, there are one or two, the nobleman Macduff, confronts the murdered king's son, Malcolm, and seeks to persuade him that it's his duty to take the throne which is rightfully his and dispatch Macbeth. This is not just for Malcolm's own sake, his prestige, but for Scotland's sake, since the country languishing under Macbeth's tyranny is sinking into chaos. Malcolm is very reluctant. Why, he asks, should I be expected to be any less ambitious, lustful, greedy, and violent than Macbeth? I'm no angel, and as human as he is, with all the human weaknesses that he has. Will Scotland be any better off under me than under Macbeth? Or perhaps we should say, he's saying, woe is me, I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips and hands. So Macduff has his work cut out to make Malcolm see it differently. Scotland needs you, he says. But the evil injected into the country by Macbeth is so pernicious. The tyrant has demoralized Duncan's son and heir, made him feel that he too is wicked, and is so paralyzed into inaction. And Scotland is thereby doomed to suffer indefinitely. Macduff does eventually succeed in freeing Malcolm from his sense of doom and self-pity, and Malcolm realizes what's been happening to him. Devilish Macbeth, by way of these trains, hath sought to win me into his power. So freed now from the spell Macbeth has cast over his soul, Malcolm is set to win back his father's throne and in turn to set Scotland free. Could there be a worse tyranny than that of Macbeth? Yes, of course. These past 2 weeks at Whitley College, I've been teaching a course on the life and thinking of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. No stranger to you here at South Yarra. He's among your A team of saints up there on the back of the church. We've been studying again the rise of Adolf Hitler, how so many in Germany in the 1930s were sucked into adulation of the dictator. How even many in the churches were deluded into thinking of him as a leader sent from God to revive the country and make it great again. How so many turned their eyes away from the mass murders of the Jews and other atrocities. And yet how at the same time there was the minority of people who not only withstood the Nazi appeal, but who during the Second World War sought to overthrow Hitler and bring in a non-Nazi government. And among them was, of course, the Christian pastor Bonhoeffer, who played his own role in the resistance. Yet he too knew how costly that resistance was. Costly not only because of the price to be paid in imprisonment, torture and death if the attempt on Hitler failed, as it eventually did, and Hitler took his revenge with Bonhoeffer himself among the martyrs. But it was also costly in another sense. As we said, taking on evil risks being mired in the evil yourself. One of the passages we looked at in the course at Whitley was a little essay that Bonhoeffer wrote at Christmas 1942. A little essay for his family and close friends involved in the resistance, reflecting on their experience of living under Hitler's 10 years in power since 1933, and their efforts to resist the tyranny. In that resistance, they had to be as wise as serpents rather than innocent as doves all the time. While much that was evil was happening, they had to remain silent, hidden or camouflaged, even pretending some of the time to be Nazis themselves, waiting for the right moment to strike. One paragraph in that essay is headed, "Are we still of any use?" And in it Bonhoeffer says this, "We have been silent witnesses of evil deeds. We have become cunning and learned the arts of deliberately cloudy and equivocal speech. Experience has rendered us suspicious of human beings. And often we have failed to speak to them a true and open word. Unbearable conflicts have worn us down. Are we still of any use? We will not need geniuses, cynics, peoples who have contempt for others, or cunning tacticians, but simple, uncomplicated, and honest human beings. Will our inner strength to resist what has been forced on us have remained strong enough and our honesty with ourselves blunt enough to find our way back to simplicity and honesty? Are we still of any use? Bonner is asking, have we been so taken up with fighting the evil of narcissism that we are in fact becoming like those enemies of ours, bitter, cynical, deceitful, brutalized by the very system and people we are opposing? Are we in subtle but real ways under its spell, even as we try to resist it? If we manage to overthrow Hitler and his regime, or if we endure to the end of the war and live to see the defeat of Germany, will we be the kind of people with the qualities needed to build a new, decent Germany of honesty, justice, and peacefulness? Once again, like Isaiah, like Prince Malcolm, it could be said they're saying, woe unto us, for we are men and women of unclean lips, and we live in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Are we fit people? Will we still be of any use? I'm sure some of us here, at least in a very different time and place, similarly know even a bit of the cost of opposing what we believe passionately to be wrong. Which of us has not experienced intolerable conflicts which have worn us down? Which of us has never come home from a meeting, perhaps even from church, dare we say, tired and dispirited and angry because people discussing peace together have put their quarrels with one another above their calling to act as one, to be at peace with one another and to bring God's peace to the world? And so we claim, saying, I'd love to bang their heads together in peace, of course. Which of us engaged in campaigns for justice and equality, for the rights of the disadvantaged and for freedom for the oppressed, for the safeguarding of creation, and disillusioned by the evident failure of the powers that be to act or in any way to respond to our demands, has not ended up in a glow of smarting self-righteousness? That self-righteousness then easily morphs into an arrogance as great as any we see in any government or official in high places. What we oppose still casts its own spell over us. We are trapped under the same curse. How does that spell manifest itself? Very simply, by producing more hatred of what we are fighting against than love for those we claim to be fighting for. Prince Malcolm is freed from the dread spell of Macbeth, who has killed his father, because Macduff opens his eyes to see the need of his country, Scotland, and all its people, and therefore his duty. Bonhoeffer, after more than 2 years in prison, and following that tragically failed attempt to overthrow Hitler in July 1944, knew that his own fate was sealed. And he wrote a poem likening his own situation to that of Moses, the leader of the people of Israel. Moses, who can see distantly the promised land, but knows that he himself will not enter it. You'd expect such a poem would vent scorn and condemnation upon Hitler and all the works of Nazism, but it breathes a rather different spirit. It closes with these words: God, to punish sin and to forgiveness you are moved. This people I have loved, but I bore its shame and its sacrifices, that suffices. Love. It's the love of Christ that dispels the power of what we oppose, which insinuates when it insinuates its dark power into our hearts. That's what the psalmist was saying, I think, in the psalm we read together. It says, though I walk in the midst of trouble, you preserve my life against the wrath of my enemies, the wrath which threatens to destroy my soul from within, the enmity of those who hate me by making me feel the same way about them. It was Martin Luther King who once said, I pray that no one will drag me so low as to make me hate them. It's with the love of Christ taking charge of us that we can venture into combat with the wrongs of our time without being dragged down by the very same demons that we oppose. How do we allow that love to take hold of us and free us from the spell? There's no magic formula to recite, no incantation to counter the curses of the witches, nor any glib program to follow in the latest paperback manual on how to live successfully. We must come to that moment of truth, the truth about ourselves, the truth that in ourselves we are indeed of no use, but knowing that what we think of as our uselessness is an emptiness which the love divine or love's excelling is longing to fill and through us to spill over into the world around us. God has a use for us, regardless of how useful or useless we think we are for God. And holding on to that, letting God love us and love through us, is faith. And that is what our worship is about. Here we are where Isaiah stood, in the temple where earth and heaven meet, where even as he sees the unspeakable vision of a heavenly glory filling the entire earth and says, woe is me, I am lost, he feels upon his unclean lips the searing touch of holy love, and his sin and guilt matter no more. The burning coal has the taste of bread and wine. God has taken care of that sin and guilt. All that matters now is that the prophet is, that we are called by God and will be sent by God. We stand on the road to Damascus, stand there with the know-all extremist Pharisee, the person, he says, is unfit to be called an apostle. Blinded by the same light that awed Isaiah, we hear the voice of the risen one we have been persecuting in our ignorance. And with the unfit apostle, we can start all over again to be filled and compelled by the love of Christ for all people. We sit in a boat that has toiled all night to no effect, and feeling useless, that all our work is futile, but we hear a voice saying, put out into the deep water. And soon, amazed by what has happened, knowing that we are in the presence of the Holy One, we say, go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful mortal. But we hear a second command. Don't be afraid. We shall be agents of God's adventurous love in ways we cannot yet imagine. By grace, we are of use. Amen.